Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, May 11, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we discuss the Juvenile Sex Offender Registration and the Adam Walsh Act. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome four learned experts to our call today, one of whom is going to moderate, so I'm going to introduce the moderator and turn things over to him. He is Mark A. Levin, the Policy Director at Right on Crime. He'll be running the show today with some opening remarks from each of our guests, then some back and forth, but as always, I think we'll be turning to the audience for questions. With that, Mr. Levin, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much. We're really pleased to have this opportunity to discuss what's both an interesting legal and public policy issue, and one that probably doesn't get as much attention as it deserves, and that is juvenile sex offender registration, given that it affects hundreds of thousands of youths who end up on these registries. And, of course, it affects the entire public, their families in particular. Certainly victims of crime have an important voice in this discussion as well. And so today we have a chance to, from several different perspectives, take a look at the legal and public policy questions that are raised by this topic. And just as a matter of introduction, the Adam Walsh Act, also known as SORNA, was passed in 2006 by Congress, and that, in fact, does require states to have not only a sex offender registry, which every state already had for adult predators, but also to include juveniles in that registry. It also includes some other mandates, some of which override certain state decisions with regard to distinguishing among risk level of offenders and so forth, and also a lifetime requirement for registration, including on juveniles, although that has been loosened by some administrative guidance by the Department of Justice. But this act has raised several issues, of course, perhaps the threshold one being one of federalism, whether in fact the federal government ought to be dictating to states in this area and in fact potentially withholding criminal justice funding for important law enforcement priorities if in fact states don't comply. But as a matter of fact, the majority of states aren't in compliance with the Adam Walsh Act overall, and indeed here in Texas, the Legislative Budget Board estimated it would cost $30 million to adjust Texas's registry to comply with the Adam Walsh Act. And indeed, the amount of federal funds at stake has dwindled with declines in some of these federal criminal justice grants that are potentially could be withheld for failure to comply. But nonetheless, it does, in fact, pose some significant federalism questions. And then, of course, the other question is just whether it's effective. And when you look at it, kids have been put on these registries as young as 9 years old, and the idea that they would still be on a public registry when they're 60 or 80 years old is really puts it in tension with some of the criminal justice empirical research about desistance from crime and, in fact, very low recidivism rates for juvenile sex offenders in particular. And a lot of what we know about adolescent development, the kids just, for the most part, tend to grow out of some of the sexual experimentation that leads to being on these registries. And then finally, there is just the question of whether this is worth the drawbacks in terms of whether there are benefits sufficient to offset potential negative effects on employment and pursuing housing and higher education and so forth that these youths may wish to do later in life. And so, in fact, one of our guests today, Eli Lehrer of the R Street Institute, has published, and we were pleased to be involved with it as well, a cost-benefit analysis looking at the sex offender registry, particularly actually only the juvenile sex offender registry. And so at this point, I'm really pleased to turn it over to Eli. And I'll also mention I'm pleased to serve with Eli on the ALEC Task Force on Criminal Justice Reform, to which he's an advisor. Prior to being head of R Street, he was vice president at the Heartland Institute in Chicago. And he's done a number of really groundbreaking things, not only in criminal justice, but insurance and other public policy areas. So Eli, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you so much, Mark, for that introduction, and thank you to the Federalist Society for the tremendous work that all of you have done over the years defending the principles of law and of constitutionalism. So the topic we're here to discuss today, of course, is sex offender registries. This is a difficult topic, but a vitally important one. Right now, 40 American states require offender registration for at least some children adjudicated juvenile delinquent. This practice is also required to a large extent under the Adam Walsh Act. States that do not register certain juveniles face the possibility of losing 10% of their burden grant funds. The practice lacks a good public safety rationale, a grounding in research, and has enormous costs. It undermines both the registry system itself and the principles at the heart of the juvenile justice system. Let me start with the evidence. There is indeed some evidence that sex offender registries themselves are effective in tracking adult pedophiles and other serial sex offenders. I support them, and I support enhancing them. But there's little evidence they do anything to discourage or deter juvenile sex offenders. A great many juveniles placed on the sex offender registries do things that either should not be criminal justice issues at all, such as having consensual sex with other teenagers or sharing nude selfies with near contemporaries. Many others are prosecuted under laws, and many in these groups are prosecuted under laws that take into account the age of the victim but not the age of the accused. This is a serious oversight. Among the juvenile sex offenders who commit truly serious acts that do require intervention, including intervention from the criminal justice system or the juvenile justice system, some may not understand what they're doing, playing games of doctor, for example. Some may simply be misguided in serious ways. Evidence that Nicole Pittman, who's our next speaker, has helped uncover is that many of the children involved with sexual abuse are themselves victims of abuse. The bottom line, and one of the important things, is that the recidivism rates for children on sex offender registries are exceptionally low. For the most part, it's very difficult to distinguish them from members of a similarly situated population. And the reasons for this, I think, should be relatively evident. Many of the behaviors that are seen as pathological and are pathological in adults, such as being attracted to underage people, are not at all pathological in teenagers. A 15-year-old who's attracted to other 15-year-olds is a normal 15-year-old. The system also has enormous costs, as Mark mentioned earlier. A cost-benefit study that my organization, the R Street Institute, produced concluded that there is a net negative social welfare cost of $3 billion from the juvenile sex offender registries. Interestingly, the single largest portion of the cost is borne by the neighbors of people who are on the registry, who suffer from decreased property values. Because a large number of child sex offenses are intrafamily, many of the costs end up being borne by the victims, who are essentially members of families that are on the registries. Many restrictions, residency and so forth, can apply to the entire family. The practice of registering juveniles also fails to advance the interests of justice. Most importantly, it simply clutters the registries. If we're to track and monitor pedophiles and other serious recidivist sex offenders, it makes sense to focus limited state resources on the worst of the worst. Including children adjudicated delinquent makes it harder to focus the registries on those who need it most. And this isn't just a theoretical problem. The case of J.C. Duggar in California shows what happens when a state's registry becomes too cluttered. Duggar, as many of you remember, was kidnapped by a man, Philip Gerito, who held her in his backyard for 18 years and sexually abused her in unspeakable ways. The household in which she was held was visited several times by police and social workers, and he was on the registry. But because resources were spread so thin, she wasn't discovered until a sharp-eyed official at the University of California asked that he be investigated. The practice is also problematic because it undermines the entire idea that the juvenile justice system is therapeutic, temporary, and takes the interests of the accused into account. If a given juvenile has done something so serious that he or she should face lifelong consequences, then there's a very good case for trying that person as an adult. And in 49 states, that's possible. But if somebody is tried in the juvenile justice system, placing these very long-term consequences is deeply unfair. There's a very strong case for ending juvenile sex offender registration, and we should do it sooner rather than later. With that, I'm very pleased to turn things over to my good friend and the leading expert and advocate on this anywhere, the person who's done the most research on it and really has the most facts on it, Nicole Pittman of Impact Justice. Nicole is an incredible advocate, and I'm very pleased to and honored to be introducing her. So, Nicole?
Okay. Thank you, Eli, and thank you to the Federalist Society for having us on this call and really taking up this issue. It's as the previous speakers have said, it's something that a lot of people don't hear about, and so I'm very excited to be talking to you all. So, as Eli was saying, first I'll just start off with who are we talking about? And before I do that, I just will say that I've been working with youth for over 20 years, and a lot of the work that I started doing with kids on registries came after we got rid of the death penalty for kids. Anyone under 18 could not be executed and sentenced to death. The brain science saying that children deserve a second chance. They can't be basically labeled for the rest of their life for something that they did when they were under 18 and young. And so I really thought that that next movement and wave of reform was going to move into working with kids on sex offender registries, because we treat them similar to like we did with capital punishment. We treat them just like adults. And so and that didn't really happen. It never really took hold. On every level, there were many people that were public defenders, including myself, that were just kind of phoning it in terms of doing defense, prosecution, and we were just putting kids on registries for life. And so really trying to dig down deep, and some of the things that you probably saw in the bio, Raised on the Registry is a report that I did based on interviewing 500 people that grew up on registries. So who are we talking about? We're talking about children in the juvenile justice system that are not convicted, they're adjudicated delinquent. Where, as we know in the juvenile justice system, it's supposed to end at 18 or 21. It's supposed to be a closed hearing. Cameras can't come in. If a child's in juvenile court for even the most serious offense, the journalist can't print their name. When we appeal that case, you can't use the child's name. You have to use initials, J.L. And it's supposed to be rehabilitative, not punitive and not retributive. However, the one instance in juvenile court where children are, all of that is thrown out, is when kids commit sex offenses. And these are kids that have been deemed to be in need of rehabilitation and can be rehabilitated and stay in juvenile court versus being removed to adult court. So what's been happening over the past, it's 20 years that we have been placing children adjudicated delinquent on registries. And there are about 200,000 children have been affected. And what registration notification and residency restrictions do, as you know, registration now is when a person has to register as a sex offender, and now they have to go sometimes up to 3-4 times a year and change and give all the information that they have, about 100 different identifiers, their shoe size, their picture. And sometimes if the child is homeless, that means they have to go every month. There's also cost with that. Notification can be a billboard sign. In the South, they do that quite often. Your face on the internet, searchable by anyone in the world, with your name, your address. and sorry, clicked here, and then also residency restrictions, which are also colloquially known as child safety zones. And with child safety zones, what that means is a person on the registry cannot pass through or stay or visit or live anywhere 100 feet or 1,000 feet, I'm sorry, 1,000 feet within a anywhere that a child would congregate. So we're talking libraries, parks, daycare centers, churches, and elementary schools. So when we put a child from juvenile court, which can range in age from 8 years old to up to 18, that means that children can't go to elementary school. They can't go to high school in many instances when these restrictions are applied. They can't live with anyone under the age of 18. Many of these offenses happen within the home. They are intrafamilial. And what happens when a child goes on the registry for inappropriate behavior with their sister or their brother, the family has to split up. And a quick little anecdote, when I was doing the interviews with the 500 children, people that were raised on registries, number one, the people that I met were, it was absolutely an amazing experience. I thought I was going to be interviewing kids that were maybe 18 or 19, and I put out bulletins around the nation, and I actually ended up interviewing people that were 30 that had been on the registry since they were 10. And what that person became and who they are was a shell of anybody that we'd want them to be. Not a danger to society, but a really hurt. And I'll explain some of those harms. But the point of what I was saying is that I also interviewed, I asked who was the most important person to get this story. So I interviewed a lot of their victims, which were usually a sibling. And one of the survivors, a sister, she was 12, he was 14 when the harm was committed. She's now in her 20s when I met her. And she said, what I want lawmakers to know is that because these cases are intrafamilial and the registration is so harsh, that a child on the registry is a family on the registry and oftentimes a victim on the registry. I've suffered the same harms that my brother has suffered. And so that's what the registration and notification can do. So the other thing to point out when we're talking about children in the juvenile justice system is the recidivism rate. If there was a show of hands or we could take questions, I would ask, what do people think that the recidivism rate of juvenile delinquents, just in general, just juvenile delinquency? It's about 50 to 60%. Recidivism rate, so reoffending for the offense that happened. Kids are rule breakers. It doesn't mean that they're bad and dangerous, but it's about 60%. For kids that commit sex offenses, the recidivism rate over 20 years is between 1 and 3%. So when we talk about putting children on registries for life, which is what is happening, that's where a lot of this problem comes down. And as I mentioned, earlier, some of the harms that I'm just going to quickly talk through that I found, the biggest harms that I found in doing the research were psychological, almost off the charts, psychological damage, kids attempting suicide. Many that I reached out to interview had killed themselves, and I interviewed their parents who wanted to speak on behalf of their children to talk about the story. The psychological damage of being labeled a sex offender from an early age on. Vigilante harm. People troll the internet and look for people to kill. Sex offenders are not a popular group. And so one of the problems with putting kids on the registry is that in most states, you don't know the date of the offense. So when you have a 30-year-old that went on the registry at the age of 14 for harming a child that was 12 or having non-consensual sex because the child couldn't consent, not force. So a dating situation, a Romeo and Juliet situation. It will read that it's an offense, sexual assault of a child under the age of 13. So you'll see a 30-year-old, and all you will read is a sexual assault of a child under 13. Many of those people have been killed because people don't know the story, and that person is labeled as a pedophile, basically, which is not the case in this situation. And so the harms, there are also other harms, employment, as we were talking about, education. and they just keep going and going. And as people get older, they go on. And then even if they try or have children, one of the biggest, and I'm getting close to the end, one of the biggest issues that we also have is since 2006, every single state has had to implement a law where it's called failure to register. And failure to register is a punishment punishable by a fine and 2 to 6 years in prison, and it's a conviction. So it's a full adult conviction that will never be erased from your record. And what a failure to register can mean, your 16-year-old grew some peach fuzz, and when he went to go register as a sex offender after 3 months, he changed his identity. And he didn't come and tell them immediately that he grew peach fuzz under his nose. He has a little bit of a mustache. That's a failure to register. That's a violation. Those laws were set up to, if somebody was trying to mask or hide their identity or hide, but when applied to children, they go very much haywire. And so we have children with 3 and 4 felony convictions on their record, spending time in adult prison for the only thing they did was in juvenile court. And again, even if we're successful in getting children off of the registry for whatever reason, they still have felony convictions saying failure to register on their record for the rest of their lives. So that's why we joined together and a lot of us worked together to stop this harm now. As Eli mentioned, there is strong support and momentum to remove kids from registries. And one of our really very strong and amazing allies is up next, Stacey Ruminat, who is the president and founder of Stop Child Predators, it's a very unlikely ally that you would think because it's coming from the survivor side. But Stacey has some powerful words that I'm really excited for you all to hear. I'll turn it over to Stacey.
Thanks, Nicole. I really appreciate that. And thank you, Mark and Eli, and for all the work that you have done, you know, on this very important issue. And thanks to everyone at the Federalist Society for agreeing to bring this issue forward today. Nicole mentioned we may seem like an unusual bedfellow to be talking this group of people who may come at these types of issues, come from different backgrounds, but coming together on it. My group, just to give a very quick background, we are a nonprofit organization based in Washington, D.C., that brings together policy experts, law enforcement officers, community leaders, and most importantly, the victims, and a lot of these child victims and their parents. And we bring everyone together to simply help combat the sexual exploitation of children and protect crime victims. And I say that because our organization was founded in 2005, just a year before the Adam Walsh Act was enacted. And our group was a very strong proponent of the Act's passage. We testified on Capitol Hill in support of the legislation. We worked with many of the victims of the types of crimes that the Act was attempting to prevent. We even brought some of those families to Capitol Hill in an effort just to help facilitate the dialogue between federal and state lawmakers to see what portions of the Act we could all agree on, what we could get into law, with the idea being we wanted very strong, tough penalties on specific adults who were preying on our nation's children. When it came to sentencing reforms, it came to registration requirements. My group and these victims that we represent, we supported to anyone who would listen, including a long list of members of Congress. We have always supported tough, long, mandatory prison sentences for the worst of the worst. These adult men who have preyed on young girls and young boys, sometimes as young as 9, 5 years old, even younger. And when we were having these conversations with lawmakers about why we supported these long prison sentences and why we supported mandatory registration that would go along with it, we did that because we were talking about sort of middle-aged men, mostly, who had previous convictions but were let out of prison early or were let out of prison after serving only a few years behind bars. Men who just didn't deserve a second or in sometimes third and fourth chance to reoffend. But I say that because in all the meetings that we had, never once were we discussing registering juveniles on public sex offender registries. Every conversation we had, every victim that we were representing, we were talking about adult predators who were preying on children. And we have lots of stories, and you know, we have represented and worked with a lot of the families of the stories that you see out on the national news, but of course also stories that never make the news. And so at the same time Congress was considering the Adam Walsh Act, we were also in the states helping to enact Jessica's Law. And that measure, most of you probably know this, but that measure calls for 25 years to life in prison and looks at electronic monitoring for released sex offenders and looks at very long registration requirements. This law is currently on the books now in 46 states. And in every instance, we've worked in all 46 of those states, in every single instance, state lawmakers carved out a minimum of at least 4 years of an age difference, this Romeo and Juliet provision. You know, never were we trying to take a freshman and a high school and senior, freshman and a senior in high school who were having consensual sex, which, you know, we can debate all day if that's a moral issue or some other issue. But, you know, we weren't trying to put these senior boys in jail or forcing them to have to register or be electronically monitored for the rest of their lives. And so, you know, again, I just come back to this idea that victims and parents who are part of this coalition, this is not what they were talking about. You know, some of this is sort of an unintended consequence. And I don't know 100% how it's even happening. You know, we've had lots of discussions around the country. Some of it could be what folks are being charged with. Some of it could be, sort of overzealous prosecutors. Some of it can be bad policy. But certainly, and as Eli mentioned, you know, a lot of this really came from the Adam Walsh Act, where Congress was sort of dangling federal funds over the states to say, if you don't comply with this component of the Adam Walsh Act, then we will withhold funds. I say this a lot around the country. Victims are so often forgotten when it comes to the criminal justice system. We work with the perpetrators, we work on the trials, we get lots of attention on all the sort of terrible things that have happened, but these victims, you know, behind all the different statistics, the victims are very real individual children who have fallen victim to sex crimes. And you know, Nicole was talking about some of the statistics on recidivism for adults who are preying on children, and that's high. You can look at groups like the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and they estimate that 1 in 5 girls and 1 in 10 boys will be sexually victimized before they reach adulthood. The biggest issue with that, because a lot of folks, including the National Center, say that statistic is probably low, but the real problem is most children will not tell anyone about it. They won't come forward. There's all sorts of studies that show kids don't feel like they have a trusted adult that they can come to, that they will be believed, that they will be taken seriously. And of course, their perpetrator is often threatening them, and they believe that. As Eli and Nicole have both mentioned, the reality, though, is these types of statistics, when we're talking about adults preying on kids, that same evidence just simply doesn't exist for juveniles caught having consensual sex with other juveniles. So, when lawmakers, our biggest issue with this is when lawmakers insist on including people on the registry who don't belong on it, these juveniles who are not the same as the adult predator. By including these juveniles, the registry itself is diluted. The importance of the registry is diluted. And we have long fought to have the registry in place as a public safety tool. And it gets harder and harder to make this argument to lawmakers, whether it's at the state level or the federal level, when we're starting to see more people be included on the registry who don't really belong there. And so we still think that the Adam Walsh Act has done many good things for victims. You know, it really was a comprehensive piece of legislation. It strengthened child pornography protections. It looked into trafficking of children, which at the time wasn't really being talked about in the United States. It looked at child prostitution. It looked at mentoring programs and all sorts of ways of trying to prevent youth crime and sexual assault. But the irony here is that at the end of the day, one of the things that state lawmakers still push back on is this juvenile, you know, registering of juveniles. And while we are still supportive of the act and still stand behind it, we just very strongly believe that lawmakers got it wrong when they mandated this registration of juveniles. And we have been talking about this ever since we started passing Jessica's Law in the states, which is included in the Adam Walsh Act, and we'll continue to talk about it, and we just really appreciate the opportunity to do so today.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Stacey, for that, and thank you for your leadership on this issue. Now I'd like to go ahead and turn it over to any questions or comments we have from those that have joined the call today.
All right. This is Dean Reuter again. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We'll start off today with three questions. Let's go to our first caller.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for this call. My name is Gary Wheaton. I'm a law school graduate, but I'm non-practicing right now. My question is, and I think one of the last commentator there just alluded to it, but said that she was not aware of what's causing this overzealous prosecution, if you will. So I'm hoping that you can delve a little deeper into that, because ultimately the solutions are going to come to, you know, what's causing this. I mean, is it prosecutors? Is it a legal culture that says, or a prosecutor says, you know, the more convictions I get, the better my record is, the more, you know, the bigger firm I'm going to go to? Is it something else? I mean, is it a combination of things? Maybe you can delve a little deeper into the causational thing that, you know, that'll help us get to some real solutions someday.
So this is Stacey Remenap with Stop Child Predators. Thank you, Gary, for picking up on that. You know, I have had this debate for many years with prosecutors because on the one hand, they generally are not supportive of mandatory sentences for a variety of reasons. But on the other hand, you see them prosecuting at, you know, what some of us might just consider sort of that overzealous prosecution. And I recently had a conversation with a prosecutor, and I feel like I'm finally getting at part of it on the charges, and that is simply the training that prosecutors go through. I mean, they're really pushed to push for the toughest sanction that they possibly can get, recognizing that the DA is going to push for the most lenient sentence that he or she can get, and so maybe somewhere in the middle it all pans out. Personally, I don't think this is a great strategy, and I think what we're seeing is our kids being harmed by this and our families being harmed by this. Eli referenced sexting and all these different types of sort of internet crimes, whether it's bullying or sexting, that are coming into play as well, where you're starting to see young girls who are taking, you know, either nude or semi-nude photos of themselves, sending it, you know, 15-year-old girl, sending it to her boyfriend, who, you know, of course, at that age is the love of her life, only they break up a couple months later, and he has forwarded this photo around to a bunch of people. And now not only is the boy who's forwarded it getting put on a sex offender registry and being picked up on distribution of child pornography, but the young girl who took it, who's the victim of this, is also the perpetrator because she took the picture and she disseminated it. And, you know, some of these cases, you see this in the news, and, to keep things in perspective, this isn't happening all the time. You know, there's a lot of education and awareness that's going into this, but you do see these cases where an area wants to, you know, whether it's a prosecutor or a judge or a school district, they just want to make an example out of someone because they want to try to stop the behavior. That is not the kind of education that we call for, of course. We actually go into schools and work with teachers and administrators and kids themselves to try to help teach them appropriate internet behavior as that becomes more and more prevalent. But still, getting back to these sentences and these charges, you know, I think there has to be an education that goes on with prosecutors to understand the sort of psychology behind these teenagers, that their, you know, that their impulses aren't the same as an adult, and that their brain hasn't fully developed the same as an adult, and that in some instances where you have teenagers who are committing very egregious sexual crimes against children, mostly especially under the age of 13, you know, 12, 13, you know, I say charge them as an adult, and with it come the adult sanctions. But when we are talking about most teenagers who are consenting, whether the law says they can legally consent or not, but it's willful behavior, it's not against their will, you know, we have to get education to these prosecutors to change this legal culture and you know, give these kids a chance. You know, there's a program, and I'll turn it over to my other panelists who may want to comment, but there's a program in Florida right now where they issue civil citations to basically teenagers who have been, you know, first-time offense, otherwise, they, you know, clean record, first-time offense, it's a misdemeanor, it's a nonviolent crime, and they hand them the civil citation, and instead of being arrested and going through the process with a record, they actually they have to pay a fine, they have to go through counseling with their family, engaged in that counseling, and then ultimately they have to perform community service, and then they go on probation, and assuming that they fulfill all those requirements, their record is completely erased, so there's not even a record of an arrest that can be found. And, you know, I'd like to see, I know that's fairly new in Florida. They're starting to study that and see that they're having a very high success rate with these young teens not reoffending in a variety of charges. And it's in most counties in Florida, and I think they hope to take this program to other states. I'd love to see more programs like that or something like that where we give these kids an extra chance, you know, or an additional chance. But, Nicole, you may have some comments on that, too.
Wow, Stacey, that's fantastic, actually, because I haven't heard that question answered, and that was really, really well put. Thank you. Yeah, mine were not that detailed, but I would say – that there's one thing that we're doing at the Center on Youth Registration Reform is, besides eliminating or working on policy to change the laws, we're also working on shifting the paradigm and the narrative. And that means actually just putting forth the research that's been sitting there for 20 years and making people aware of it and comfortable with using it. So, for instance, going to 37 states between 2009 and 2006 and 2010, and every single lawmaker would say these kids recidivate at a rate of 100%. And, you know, going there with a study and saying right now it's 5%. We just had a study that came out in your state that has 1%. So really shifting and changing that narrative is one. The second thing is we don't have any solutions in the United States. This is more somewhat of a public health approach, or at least we need a public health approach. So what that means is that without a public health approach, if you think that you have a person, whether adult or child, has some issue that they might say, you know, I could possibly end up doing this inappropriate harm, or a parent sees something inappropriate, the only way you can get a child help is by them hurting someone sexually or them being hurt sexually, and that goes in the system. There is no mechanism at this point in America where you can take a child in and say, can you help treat my child for these sexual behaviors, because everyone is a mandated reporter, and it goes through the juvenile justice system or the criminal justice system. So we don't have primary or secondary prevention. We only have tertiary after the fact. So that's a problem that we're really dealing with. And the third is what I just actually met with the Department of Justice about yesterday, is moving the funds that we are putting into the back end with registering all of these kids and putting it towards, number one, treating survivors, and then number two, refunding, which was defunded in the 60s, refunding studies on child sexual behavior. We defunded it in the 60s, which means we don't have any benchmarks. So if there are any parents on the call, it's like taking your child to the doctor and then taking the child's height and you saying, how's my child doing? And they're saying, we don't have any research to compare them to any of the other kids, but we're going to use what we have from 1950, so they're a little tall. So we don't have any funded research on what is normative behavior anymore. So that's where a lot of the kids that are doing very, very, very adolescent-type behaviors are going on the registry. So those would be the three things I would say.
This is all. Thank you so much, Stacey and Nicole. What I would add, of course, is that for all of the talk that, you know, kids are doing all this stuff they weren't in the past, the evidence we do have, which admittedly is limited, suggests that it's probably more or less the same as it's ever been. Teen pregnancy rates are lower today than they were in the 1950s. In fact, they're pretty close to an all-time low, for example. The other thing worth mentioning is how much of this, there are all sorts of things that are overzealous, there are all sorts of things that are silly. Some of it's also just inadvertent. When a law doesn't mention the age of the accused and only takes the victim's age into account, that results in a sizable part of this problem. It really is a different thing when there's a small age difference.
I thank you guys very much for what you're doing, and also that was great answers. Really appreciate it. And one more thing I might suggest is, and I know that your advocacy is also policy or political, and I know it's very difficult when you're making friends in Washington to call people out, but if your websites, if you ever do have particular lawmakers that are blocking or in the way, I would love to see a little naming and shaming on that end, too. But great answers. Thank you very much. I'm off. Thank you.
Thank you.
We still have three questions pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. For now, let's take the next call.
This is Richard Belzer. I'm the economist who wrote the benefit-cost analysis that Eli has referred to earlier. I've had a number of opportunities since completing it to discuss the monograph with some professional audiences and a number of lay audiences, so where people are not technically sophisticated. One of the things that I have encountered, and I don't know if these are representative, but I'm afraid they may be, is that when we talk about how much of registration, particularly notification, cost to juveniles, the most common reaction that I have received is something along the lines of, well, good. I have not encountered a great deal of sympathy for them. And it may well be because in the audience, the perception of what we're talking about is different from reality. That could easily be true. However, when I have tried to extend the conversation to where the other costs are, to the costs on neighborhoods and to homeowners and others living near those who are registered, regardless of whether they're juveniles or not, that seems to have changed the discussion and opened up an opportunity for conversation and reconsideration of the merits of the program. But what I've encountered is talking about the cost to the juveniles themselves and even to some extent to their families, I have just not found very much receptivity to that.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, this is Stacey with Stop Child Predators. I'll just jump in one second and add, you know, you're absolutely right. I mean, we come across that, and I really think because these types of crimes are so personal and emotional for the victim and for people who either may know the victim or know someone in a similar situation, that people react very, you know, that there's just not a lot of sympathy. I think also in our work on the registry that we have found most people, most parents, people, neighborhoods, you know, looking at the registry, they don't differentiate the juvenile from the adult. They see the sex offense and it just registers things so vile that they you're absolutely right. The perception is very different from the reality. The cost of the homeowners and you know, and the neighbors, I do think that that is a important part to that plays into this conversation, because you know, neighborhoods, people who decide to buy in certain neighborhoods, you know, they do so based on crime, based on good schools, based on people who may be like them. You know, they purchase into a neighborhood for a variety of reasons, and their personal safety is definitely one of those reasons. So I think any time that you can put the argument, you know, change the argument to that, you do have that opportunity to sort of discuss the merits of the registry. And it's a reason, you know, where I say we are proponents of keeping the registry in place for public safety, but cleaning it up and making sure that people don't lump juveniles or someone who is urinating in public or, you know, a long list of people who are ending up on the registry, don't lump them all together for the reasons that you say.
Anybody else want to comment on that, or should we move on to the next question? All right, two questions pending. If you want to join the queue again, push star and then pound on your telephone. Let's take another call now.
Hello, this is Matt Mugridge. I'm a criminal law practitioner in Virginia. And my question is, and I apologize, I may have missed the first 10 minutes of this superb panel discussion, but something that's always bugged me about the sex offender register just as a legal concept, and that is, it's so easy to dump people on it and to say, well, these are people now back in the community, they've served their sentence, which was imposed by a court, and now they're here, and so their sort of punishment never really ends. There's something kind of extrajudicial and vigilante about it that really bugs me. I mean, if they're a danger, then they should be locked up. And if they're not locked up, then they shouldn't be, you know, down in a rural county in Virginia, there's actually a camp, like, in the woods, no joke, of sex offenders. And they even, you know, people, guardians ad litem, sometimes, you know, go visit the camp, the sex offender camp. And that's just, I find that offensive, but it's such an there's such an unappealing part of the population that no one goes to bat for them, and everybody loves the sex registry. You know, it's online, it's your neighborhood. Oh, there's one moved in. They get housed by the federal government sometimes in motels that are local. So it's so unworkable, and it works so much injustice on juveniles. It's so undiscriminatory. Has anybody ever said, you know, to hell with the sex offender registry? It doesn't work. It doesn't prevent crimes. It's just unfair to the people on it, and it's not really informative to the people who use it. It's just a bad tool. I don't know if anyone's addressed like that legal question. It's not really sort of policy. How can we make the world better? But just legally, I really do find it kind of philosophical, like from a legal philosophical point of view, sort of extrajudicial, and there's a vigilante character to it that you know, it's just sort of offensive.
Well, this is Mark Levin. One thing I would bring up is there are, I don't think it's been mentioned yet, but there are also private registries, both for juveniles and perhaps some adults are on there too, but they're visible to law enforcement. I think public schools have access to them, and you know, certainly, for example, a licensing board that is licensing a child care provider. So those who really have a clear need for that information. And so one of the solutions is there may be some individuals who that don't need to be exposed on a public registry that can be on these private registries based on certain criteria. So that's one of the kind of solutions that some jurisdictions have pursued.
The
This is Eli Lehrer. What Mark said is absolutely right. Now, the best available economic research on the registries does show that registration per se does have primarily a deterrent effect on adult sex offenders. So there does seem to be some evidence that it is working as advertised for some portion of the population. This doesn't necessarily mean that it's right, but it does indicate that it's somewhat effective. But the practice of public notification, there's basically no evidence for it and a fair amount against it. So the idea of having these registries, of even doing more in some cases to keep people, to keep serious sex offenders out of schools, for example, which we don't do as good a job of as we could, might need to be enhanced. And just as all states have ways of, civilly committing people who, are going to be significant harm to themselves or others, there are some sort of civil commitment for sex offenders is, in my judgment, appropriate. But registries have a function, but they're overused, and their overuse actually makes them less effective at what they're supposed to be doing, which is providing a tool to track people who are truly dangerous. I have to say that I think politically, as the original questioner pointed out, politically this is a very hard thing to do. Frankly, I'm not sure if it's even possible because for anybody who's currently on the registry, because if they ever were removed, there would be an immediate popular and probably quite profitable effort to capture all of the information before it was removed in some private site, which would then last forever.
This is Nicole. Very quickly, I agree. The comments are in regards to what you were asking about litigation. We have, on behalf of Children with Juvenile Law Center, challenged in Ohio as well as Pennsylvania registration, and that's as well as non-public for both of those states. So kids, non-public, challenged on cruel and unusual and have won. So it's been declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania and Ohio. And so Juvenile Law Center, if you go to that website, they have those cases on there. And just the thing to point out is in Pennsylvania, they just actually put children on the registry. So it was less than a year of having children on a non-public registry that the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania thought that it was still cruel and unusual. So when it applies to kids, it is very detrimental. And so I agree with you with the litigation.
Thank you.
Once again, if you have a question, we've got just one question pending now. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Take what might be our final call here.
Hi, this is Teresa Collette. I'm a law professor at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota. This is not an area of my expertise, but like any lawyer who's active in their community, and particularly a faith community, when a fellow member of the faith community has a problem, your priest or pastor or imam or rabbi will often seek you out to be the local pro bono society. And I just wanted to say how encouraged and delighted I am that the Federalist Society is hosting this conversation, because about 20 years ago, I was brought into a case with a child who was under the age of 12. There was no sexual intercourse involved. There was no violence involved. But because of the political stature of the father of the girl, the child was prosecuted. And what we discovered in the state of Texas at that time, to the surprise of both the prosecutor and the judge and the family, was that an adult could be excused from the registration of requirement by the court being persuaded by at least two mental health professionals certifying that they posed no future threat, but that same exception did not apply to juveniles. And I was brought in after the conviction but before sentencing, and was very frank with the parents and said, look, I have no criminal expertise. I didn't even take criminal procedure in law school, but I'm a smart lady who has lots of friends, and, you know, we can figure out how to do the appeal on this, and I will get you real criminal, appellate people to help. And the family were so emotionally strung out and financially strung out from the defense in the trial court that they just simply could not find the emotional resources. And I begged them. I remember saying to them, your son will never be a priest. He will never be a doctor. He will never be a policeman. You have to understand the consequences of this. You cannot give up at this point, and they just couldn't bear it. They just, because I think we would have had a very good shot, even in the Texas Supreme Court, with an equal protection claim against the registration requirement. And so I want to commend your work. I'm delighted to hear about it. I teach a course on regulation of human sexuality, and I will be having students think about this area for notes and comments for law review. So thank you for doing this. So thank you.
Well, thank you. And let me just mention, as we conclude, there is an opportunity now to comment on, they're taking public comment, the Department of Justice is on, and Nicole can, and Eli can elaborate, but on some proposed revisions to the regulations implementing juvenile sex offender registration. And many of us are planning to submit in response to that request for comment. And generally, it would give states a lot more flexibility. And so I think it's very consistent with what everyone's been discussing. But does anyone want to add anything on that before we wrap up?
Just very briefly, the administration's proposals are a very modest step in the right direction. I'm not quite clear how much they could do under the current statute. I think they can do more. This is ultimately going to require first a legislative fix at the congressional level and then action in roughly 40 states separately.
Absolutely. Perfectly put.
Okay, well, thank you again. I guess at this point, I think we're ready to conclude. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. This is Dean Royer. Let me thank all four of you for your participation today. This is certainly an enlightening discussion. Let me thank the audience as well for dialing in and for your thoughtful questions. A reminder to check the Federalist Society's website. We are scheduling a call that might well take place on Friday, looking at some of the Exxon and Competitive Enterprise Institute subpoena issues and free speech issues. So monitor the website, monitor your emails for that as well. But until that next scheduled call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.